And yeah, we're coming to you from the Temple of Humanity in just north of Parramatta, in the land of the Burramuttigal people of the Darug Nation, just next to the Parramatta River, after which which is named after them. And we pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and respect the custodianship of the land, which has never been ceded. For this evening, we'll do some chanting, we will do some meditation, and we will continue with our series of talks on dependent origination. So let us begin with the chanting of the respects of the Triple Gem. Does anybody here need the chanting sheets? Do we need chanting sheets? You sure? Do we have chanting sheets? We don't know where they are. We're lost. No problems. So our Dhamma friends, Deepika and Radha, who are normally here to open up, are currently away in Indonesia. So they're spending a few of the weekend in Indonesia, going to Borobudur and some of the sacred sites there. So that's really nice, with a few Dhamma friends. All right, let us begin. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sammasambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarathi Sattha Deva Manusanang Buddho Bhagavati Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandittiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatam Veditabo Vinyuhiti Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yadidam Chattari Purisa Yugani Attha Purisa Pungala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo, Pahuneyo, Dakirneyo, Anjalikaraniyo, Anutarang Punyaketang Lokasati. Okay, very good. So where we are giving the talk here in Parramatta is basically right in or right next to a large urban place. There's a lot of people around. Just walking here, walking through Parramatta, you see all the tall buildings, you see all the people around, and you see all of the activity that goes on. And as a monk, when you go through these places, you know, it seems so stark how everything is driven by desire, and how everything that is built, everything, the way people dress, the way that they do things, the cars they drive, everything has been driven by desire. And the amazing lengths that people go to try to get the things that they desire, and the way that people will compromise their principles and lose sight of what's valuable in order to get what it is that they want. And of course, when they get what they want, then it's never satisfying, so they have to try and get something more, and thus it goes around. And which is why in the 80s the capitalists started saying greed is good, thus explicitly defining our dominant ideology as exactly opposed to Buddhism, like the literal exact opposite of what the Buddha said. So the Buddha said that greed is bad, and one of the things that the reason why greed is bad is because it doesn't allow your mind to be still. As long as you're wanting something, as long as your mind is being driven by the need to be somewhere else, to have something else, to want something else, then it will never be settled. And this is an apparently endlessly repeating cycle, which we can all see when we come to meditate. Because when we come down to sit down to meditate, the mind is already spinning off with all of those things we want, or all the our desires, all our wishes, all our longings. Or maybe it goes into the opposite, into our anger and aversion, which is usually just comes out of frustrated desire. So here we are in this whirlpool of desire, wishing only to find peace. You know, the funny thing is, though, that even though we're in this environment where there is all of that activity and all of that desire, just coming here, we're walking for a few minutes beside the river, and it's quite peaceful, actually. I kind of like it. It's kind of like all of the things are there, but there's something about the river which keeps people peaceful. I always remember that Herman Melville wrote very beautifully about this at the beginning of Moby Dick. He talked about the mysterious power that the ocean has to draw people to it, and they just sit contemplating and just watching. They don't know why, but somehow to just be there and exerted this magnetic force. And as we're sitting here, you know, next to the river, and it's not particularly loud or noisy or anything here, and I feel like it's quite a peaceful little place. So, like that, even in the midst of all of this whirlpool, that peace is just kind of right there. I'm kind of moving towards using this as an analogy for the mind, right? Your mind might be whirling around with all of its desires and needs and restlessness and everything, but just like there's a peaceful river next to the city, same way that there's a state of peace which is actually just next to all that busyness. And if only it were as easy to step down to that state of peace as it is to step down to the riverside and to watch the water there. So the funny thing is, of course, that if you want to visit the river, then the amount of desire that you have to visit the river doesn't really matter. And in fact, if you have that desire to visit the river, then that can be counterproductive, because you're sitting in your office doing your work or whatever, stuck in a traffic jam or something like that, and then you're thinking, if only I was beside that quiet riverside. Ah, it would be so peaceful there. It would be so nice. Eventually, you make it and you are beside that quiet riverside. But then there's some kids laughing and messing around. There's a car horn tooting. Somebody's playing some music somewhere. You're like, come on, this is my quiet time. Get out of here. So it's like the more that you want it, then actually the less quiet it is. But if you don't have that desire, if you just think, oh, I'll go to the river, and you go down there, and then there's a few other things happening around, it doesn't really matter too much. It's still peaceful, actually. So rather than thinking of our mind as something that has to have that, complete purity and silence and stuff, it goes in stages. And when we sit and to meditate, you know, it's like going down to the river. We're still next to the city. There's still some of the noise of the city around, and you can still hear some of the distractions and things. It's not completely quiet, but it's still a lot more peaceful than it was just a minute ago. So this is kind of how meditation works. It's not just like one thing where the mind is simply wiped clean and then you just abide in ultimate emptiness. It would be lovely if that was the case. But for most of us, that's not the case. So we take it step by step, and we appreciate that peace and that silence and that emptiness that nature is gracious enough to allow us to participate in. Anyway, let's do some meditation. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Now coming near to the end of the meditation, bring your mind back into the sounds around you, into the feelings in your body, and take a minute to cast back over the course of the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did my mind change? How did my mind feel at the beginning? What did I do? How did it feel in the middle? And then at the end of the meditation, what things were supporting the meditation? What things were taking me away from the meditation? So each time at the end of the meditation, we should reflect like this. This is called Dhamma Vicaya or Dhammanupassana. And it's a reflection into the causes and effects of the meditation. Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Let's just take a break for a few minutes and come back for some Dhamma talk. Okay, very good. So welcome back, everybody. And good to see you all here. Venerable Bhairatna, I hope your vasa has been going well for you. I must admit, when I look at you sitting there, I'm like, I feel very, like I was talking before about desire and so on. I'm seeing those shelves full of books at the back of you, and I'm thinking, oh. Those look nice. Anyway, Melanie and Marion, good to see you. Good to see you together there. And Dhiriyupa, just wanted to mention, for those of you who are here last week, might recall we discussed some mistaken interpretations of dependent origination, and I read some passages from Ajahn Buddhadasa. And one of the phrases that he had, which was quite memorable, he said something like, in this modern age of atoms, space exploration, and ping-pong diplomacy, right? And like, okay, so when you hear that, you might think, okay, well, this obviously is a joke, right? He's obviously setting up a classic, you know, three-part joke and cracking a bit of a joke about her. And I think actually it is quite a dry humor that he's doing there. I think he's like, basically, the humor is that we live in a world where we have space exploration and everything, but we still have the way we organize our diplomacy is still just throwing things back and forth at each other. So that's what they call ping pong diplomacy. However, while that is the obvious explanation, I do wish to point out the fact that our dear friend Dhiriyupa is widely known to her friends as Ping Pong. And she was, in fact, working in the US Embassy. So I'm not sure, you know, I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions about that, whether that's a veiled reference in Ajahn Buddhadasa's book about that. But I'll just leave you to make up your own minds about that one. All right, fine. So for this week, and I think we're going to be looking at some of the practical dimensions of dependent origination. So let us begin right away with Samyutta Nikaya number 12.3. I'll pop these into the chat as we come to them. Okay, so let me read through 12.3. Mendicants, I will teach you the wrong practice and the right practice, the Miccha Patipada and the Samma Patipada. Listen and apply your mind well, I will speak. Yes, sir, they replied. The Buddha said this. And what's the wrong practice? Ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choices are a requirement for consciousness. That's how this entire mass of suffering originates. This is called the wrong practice. And what's the right practice? When ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. That's how this entire mass of suffering ceases. This is called the right practice. So it's a very kind of interesting sutta, which is giving us yet another dimension of dependent origination. Notice that this has quite a strategic position within the collection, right? It's number 12.3. That means we've just been introduced to the basic teachings on dependent origination in the first one. We've been given the analysis of the meaning of the terms in the second one. So these are the two foundational suttas on dependent origination. And now the third one is emphasizing the role of practice in relationship to dependent origination. Now this, so Mike is offering another interpretation of ping pong diplomacy, diplomacy to be the Nixon era dialogue with China. Yes, Mike, that might sound like a rational argument because it's on Wikipedia, but still. Anyway, moving on. Where was I? It is the right ear. Yes, Mike, I'm sure. And I'm sure, in fact, that is what he was referring to. Yeah. Okay, so where was I? Wrong practice, right practice. Yes. Okay, so this sutra is then situating dependent origination as part of the path. Now, it's not telling us too much more than that, right? It's not really telling us why it's the right practice or in what sense it's a practice. So we can look at some other contexts to see that. But the one thing that we can say right away is that, like, if we consider cessation as the right practice, then there's a lot of not doing things that's part of the Buddhist path, right? For example, like not killing, not stealing, and so on. But also in meditation, like there's a lot, the process of meditation can be seen as an anupubha nirodha, a gradual cessation. And so each step of meditation, the disturbances, the movements, the whirlpool, the heat, the fever in the mind is gradually stilled and gradually comes to cease. So that whole process of cessation is that that settling and that stilling and that moving towards peace. So that there is a this is giving us an insight into how we can situate dependent origination with regards to practice. But we will move on from this. Oh, and let me just say, you know, please do give some questions. So most of you, I think, or at least many of you have been to these classes over the last several weeks now. And so we have covered quite a lot of ground, and I'm sure many of you have many questions. I pride myself on leaving you with more questions at the end of the talk than you had at the beginning. I think that's a good way to get through a Dhamma talk. So if you do have questions, hopefully the next couple of classes won't be so dense. I'm well aware that the last few have been quite dense, so hopefully these ones will be a bit lighter, so give you a bit of space. So please do ask questions, whether they're directly relevant or not. That's fine. Okay, so let's have a look at a couple of ways that the Nidana Samyutta talks about practice. All right, so the very next sutta, the Samyutta 12.4, gives us a hint. So here we're talking about the reflection of Vipassi, the past Buddha. And in fact, the same discourse is, same reflection is told of all the past Buddhas leading up to the present Buddha, Gautama. And which, of course, is interesting in and of itself. But I'm going to just skip forward to 12.10 and look at what the Buddha said about his own practice. Mendicants, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, I thought, alas, this world has fallen into trouble. It's born, grows old, dies, passes away, and is reborn. So this is the basic reflection on the nature of dukkha in the world which the Bodhisattva has. And just a brief note here on the translation. So before my awakening, pubeva bhikkhave sambodha anabhisambuddhassa, so when I was not yet unawakened, bodhisatta seva sato ahosi. So the word bodhisatta is used here as it is normally used in the early texts to mean one who is intent upon awakening. So the root here, I take the root as being shakta, rather than sattva. So I think the formation of bodhisattva is like the word bodhisattva, the Pali word bodhisattva into the Sanskrit bodhisattva, I think was an incorrect Sanskritization, or was an interpretation that arose later on. But certainly the sense in the early texts is the bodhisattva is the one intent on awakening. And it's usually only used for the Buddha after he's gone forth and before his enlightenment, so for the 6 years of striving, normally. All right, so alas, this world has fallen into trouble. It's born, grows old, dies, passes away, and is reborn, yet it doesn't understand how to escape from this suffering from old age and death. Oh, when will an escape be found from this suffering from old age and death? So this is that lament which of the bodhisattva, and the lament which I think is very relatable. I think in one way or another, we've probably all experienced this. We've all seen the suffering in the world. We've all seen that actually the world doesn't really know how to get out of the suffering. And then that feeling of that longing to be able to find that freedom. Right? It's what they call niramisa domana, so it's that longing. So then, now obviously this is a short abbreviated account, okay? So the Buddha is not telling you all the details of his going forth and practice and all of those things. It occurred to me, when what exists is there old age and death? What is a requirement for old age and death? Then through rational application of mind, I penetrated with wisdom. When rebirth exists, there's old age and death. Rebirth is a requirement for old age and death. So this is giving us an example of the Buddha's reflective process that led to his enlightenment. And this already clarifies, I think, a number of things. First of all, his understanding of dependent origination was in some sense reflective. Like it wasn't just like a vision of reality. Like to some extent, obviously it is, right? To see and to have an insight at that level of realization is to see the whole unfolding of things in one intuitive realization. But in order to understand it, he took it factor by factor and reflected upon each factor and each detail, and then tried to work out what exactly is going on. This particular detail, what exists is there old age and death. What is a requirement for old age and death? Then when rebirth exists, there's old age and death. Rebirth is a requirement for old age and death. And the use of the word yoniso manasikara, right? Yoniso, which I translate as rational application of mind. Yoniso, looking back to the cause. Yeah. Now, there's something I've always found that there's something strangely disturbing and strangely like a stealth wisdom in this particular link in dependent origination. Like normally when we think, oh, what is old age? Well, you know, if you ask people, like, what is old age caused by? They'll say, oh, you know, it's hard living, it's smoking cigarettes, it's doing this, it's doing that. And they think you get all that, say, it's just nature, right? Or people say, oh, it's just nature, it's inevitable, and those kinds of things. It's kind of okay. But when we're a baby, we don't think, oh, my goodness, they're going to be old soon. But you know what? They will be. And it's wild. You just like, it's crazy. One day your mum's packing you off to school, and then the next day you turn around and you're like 60 or something. You're like, what happened? Where did all that go? I thought I had time. I haven't even had time to be young yet, and I'm already old. What the hell is this about? And so we want to see that what is creating life. We want to see what is creating the arising of birth and all of those things that delight us and bring us joy. And we want to hide away or not notice the fact that that's also what's bringing suffering in the end. Venerable Pasanna says, life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. That's... That is very dark, Venerable. That's very dark. I love it. Yeah. So this is why, when we look at these things, you know, we look at it and this is what the Buddha says, and you say, oh, birth causes old age and death. Yeah, okay, fine. It seems, once you see it, it's obvious. But it's taking that time to really understand it, to really reflect that this is what this process is. So and so on through all of these links. So this is giving us an insight into one aspect of the way that dependent origination is practiced. And so we're looking here at a process of reflective understanding of mind. Now, this particular sutta doesn't, you know, it just says what it says. It doesn't give us much context. But one of the things which tends to happen is that when you reflect in this way, that that's okay, and you can get some wisdom and so on, but it usually doesn't go very deep, and it usually doesn't really do that work of uprooting or changing your mind in a fundamental way. And so there has to be other conditions in the practice that's going to support that. So let's have a little look at some of the other discourses here to see how they bear upon that particular question. Okay. Any questions before we go on? No? You look like you have a question. No? Okay. Just have a questioning face. That's all right. Okay. So this one, next one is Sangyutta 12.41. So Venerable Dhammakipa makes the observation that all phases of aging from the time of conception have elements of suffering in them, not just when one is old. Yeah. Of course, very true. Okay, so at Savati, the householder Anathapindika went to the Buddha, bowed and sat down to one side. Seated to one side, the Buddha said to the householder Anathapindika, householder, when a noble disciple has quelled five fears and enmities, possesses the four factors of stream entry, and has clearly seen and penetrated the noble system with wisdom, they may, if they wish, declare of themselves, I've finished with rebirth in hell, the animal realm, and the ghost realm. I've finished with all places of loss, bad places, the underworld. I'm a stream enterer. I'm not liable to be reborn in the underworld and am bound for awakening. So what are the five fears and enmities that they have quelled? Anyone who kills living creatures brims with fear and enmity both in this life and in lives to come and experiences mental pain and sadness. That fear and enmity is quelled for anyone who refrains from killing living creatures. Anyone who steals brims with fear and enmity both in this life and lives to come and experiences mental pain and sadness. That fear and enmity is quelled for anyone who refrains from stealing. Anyone who commits sexual misconduct brims with fear and enmity. Anyone who lies brims with fear and enmity. Anyone who consumes beer, wine, and liquor intoxicants brims with fear and enmity, both in this life and in lives to come, and experiences mental pain and sadness. That fear and enmity is quelled for anyone who refrains from consuming beer, wine, and liquor intoxicants. These are the five fears and enmities they have quelled. What are the four factors of stream entry that they possess? So when a noble disciple has experiential confidence in the Buddha, that blessed one is perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. They have experiential confidence in the teaching. The teaching is well explained by the Buddha, apparent in the present life, immediately effective, inviting inspection, relevant, so that sensible people can know it for themselves. They have experiential confidence in the Sangha. The Sangha of the Buddha's disciples is practicing the way that's good, direct, systematic, and proper. It consists of the four pairs, the eight individuals. This is the Sangha of the Buddha's disciples that is worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods, worthy of hospitality, worthy of a religious donation, worthy of greeting with joined palms, and is the supreme field of merit for the world. And a noble disciple's ethical conduct is loved by the noble ones, unbroken, impeccable, spotless, unmarred, liberating, praised by sensible people, not mistaken, and leading to immersion. These are the four factors of stream entry that they possess. And what is the noble system that they have clearly seen and penetrated with wisdom? A noble disciple carefully and rationally applies the mind to dependent origination itself. When this exists, that comes to be. When this doesn't exist, that is not. Due to the arising of this, that arises. Due to the cessation of this, that ceases. Ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choices are a requirement for consciousness. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. When ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. That's how this entire mass of suffering ceases. This is the noble system that they have clearly seen and penetrated with wisdom. When a noble disciple has quelled five fears and enmities, possesses the four factors of stream entry, and has clearly seen and penetrated the noble system with wisdom, they may, if they wish, declare of themselves, I've finished with rebirth in hell, the animal realm, and the ghost realm. I've finished with all places of lost, bad places, and the underworld. I am a stream enterer. I'm not liable to be reborn in the underworld, and am bound for awakening. So good on you. So the stream enterer gets their moment in the sun here, right? And they get to sort of flex on that a bit. Yes, I'm a stream enterer. Sotapattanomhi, I think it is. So remember that stream enterer has not completely gone beyond all conceit, so it's okay for them to have a bit of pride in their achievements. And why not? Okay? Why not? Right, they're still bound for awakening. They can let go of conceit later on. I think it's all right. So this is obviously giving quite a nice setting and a few different dimensions that gives us a context for dependent origination, right? So rather than purely just like a teaching that's hasn't got any connection to anything else, here it's integrated with some other familiar Dhamma teachings, and let me go over those a little bit in brief. So the first idea is it's kind of interesting, is this way of talking about the precepts as being five fears and enmities, right? Bhaya and Vera. So the idea here is that when we live in a way that is hostile and harmful to others, then we feel that inside ourselves. It becomes, there's like an emotional backlash that we feel, that we feel afraid because we cause fear to others, so we feel afraid because of that. And if we go around making enemies, then we feel that enmity inside ourselves. So refraining from harm is a gift of freedom for fear for countless creatures as well as for oneself. This is in Anguttara 8.39. If we look at parallels for this particular kind of phrasing, the Bhaya and Vera, interesting is that Kautilya in his Arthashastra says that one can use fears and enmities in order to, spies can use them in order to create fear and dissension. That's how you achieve your goals, which I thought was quite interesting because that's like still a fundamental part of statecraft today. Creating fear and enmity in order to split people apart from each other and achieve your goals. Interesting that that's so. Arthashastra is like 2,000 something years old. That's how governments work. Okay. So they can declare of themselves. So they obviously finish with all of these different kinds of lower realms. Place where the Buddha said originally he didn't tell people because he didn't want the stream entrants to get lazy. Right, but the stream enterer has cut off certain fetters that would have led them to be rebirth in these lower realms, and with that cutting, the attachment to doubts, views about a self, and so on, then they're not able to get reborn in the underworld, and they are bound for awakening. So this is an interesting phrase, Sambodhi Parayana. And this is talked about elsewhere in the Samyutta Nikaya. I think it's Okantika Samyutta. I think it is. So the basic idea here is that, like, if we think of it in terms of conditionality, so you know, the Buddha was not big on talking about destiny. Right? He didn't believe that things were kind of foreordained, right? You can't like say that this is what's going to happen and that what person's going to happen and so on. But he did say that he could understand where paths lead. So he says, if you're walking down this path, then that's where that path is going to take you, right? So this is not having some magical power of seeing the future, but it is understanding how things work. Now, there comes a certain point in your life where you are, in a way, destined to become enlightened. And this is what we call, in fact, technically we call the Sadhanusari and Dhammanusari, the one who's entering the path to stream entry. And they are already destined to enlightenment, even though they haven't actually yet seen dependent origination or the Four Noble Truths. So this is something like, basically what's happening here is that the conditions are fulfilled, but the fruit is not yet ripe. That's basically what the Buddha is saying here. So my simile for this is my famous Cottesloe Beach simile. I don't know if I've told the folks had done that one recently. Have I done that one recently? Do you know the Cottesloe Beach simile?
Maybe.
I should do it again. Do it again, they say. Do it again. by popular demand, do the Cottesloe Beach simile. So when I was a kid, I grew up in Perth. And any of you who have been to Perth will know that one of the great things about Perth when you're a kid is summer holidays. Oh, my goodness, fantastic. Just endless days of sunshine and no school, no responsibilities. Fantastic. And if you're lucky enough to live not too far from the beach, then you can ride there. So we lived, how long? It wasn't that far, but I mean, it seemed like a long time when you're a kid, right? I'm guessing maybe half an hour, maybe an hour's bike ride or something like that from the beach. And so we get on our bikes with our mates and we go riding down there. And at the beaches in Perth, like on the way to them, there's these big hills, like where the sand dunes were. So you got like these, I mean, again, this is when you're a kid, they seem like big hills. You probably go back there today and there's hardly anything there, but still. And you're right, you've been driving through the heat, right? And it's hot. Your mum's like, put on the sunscreen. You're like, sure. You come home, all your skin's peeling off and everything. And, you know, but you're really looking forward to getting to the beach because you can go for a swim and it's going to be really nice and everything. And then you're riding up that last hill. And as you're riding up that last hill, you can, like, smell the air and you know, oh, yeah, this is it. This is the last hill. You've got a sense for, like, a vibe. It's in the atmosphere. It's in the light, you know. And there comes a point when you press your pedal down, right? You're on the way up the hill and you press your pedal down and you've got enough energy to be able to make it to the top, right? You're not even quite at the top yet, but you've got enough momentum. There's the last pedal push that's giving you that momentum. You don't even necessarily know what that pedal push was, right? I mean, you can probably guess, but there's a point where you've actually got the energy you need to make it to the top, but you haven't even seen the beach yet, right? So then if you keep pedaling, or even if you don't keep, if you stop pedaling at that point, you'll coast and you'll make it anyway. But if you keep pedaling you get to the top, and once you get to the top, you can see the beach in front of you. And you're no longer, you can just smell it, but you see the sparkling waters. Perth beaches are really nice. Water's really clear, sand is really shining white. Yeah, and so you see that beautiful beach down in front of you. So then you're like, yay, and then you ride really fast down the other side, throw your bike down and then run and jump into the water. And then all of that heat and all of that sweat and all of that fatigue just goes off. You're like, now this is where I'm meant to be. So in this simile, the one who's on the path to stream entry, what they call the faith follower or Dhamma follower, the Sadhanusari and Dhammanusari, this is like when you've just made that last pedal push on the way up the hill. You can't even see the beach yet. You can't even see the ocean. But you've put in place the conditions that will lead you to going there. Sorry, folks online, I'm not sure if I just dropped out or something, but I think we should be back again. So even if you don't put any more effort, you're going to coast and make it on the way down. But, of course, you should put some effort in. Why not, right? So you keep on cycling and then When you see the water from the top, that's like stream entry. So stream entry is like the vision of the Dhamma, right? But you're not yet actually bathing in it, yeah? So that's when you arrive down, and then that's arahantship, is when you plunge into the ocean like that. So this is my little simile that explains these stages of enlightenment, or stages of the path of enlightenment. Just to continue with the sutta, so this is what it means by the bound for awakening. And so now the five fears and enmities that they have quelled, of course, these are the five precepts. And, of course, the five precepts taught many times in the suttas. Not to kill living beings, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to consume beer, wine, and liquor intoxicants. So these are the basic precepts. I won't talk in too much detail about these. I've talked about them on many other occasions, and we'll do it again in the future. I'll just say from a translation point of view, usually the last one, Sura Meraya Madhya Pamada Thayi, says here. So this is it's a tricky one to figure out exactly, because often like the names of different kind of liquors and alcohols are always a bit varied, and the people who are making them up are usually drunk. So, and you think about it today, like how many different names are there for different drinks and so on and so forth. So it's a bit difficult sometimes to figure out exactly what they want, what they are. But in the suttas, when it talks about sura, actually in the Vinaya it defines sura as being brewed from grains. So yeah, it must be some kind of beer or something like a beerish kind of thing. Whereas meraya is probably brewed from fruit. So something like a wine of some kind, yeah. So that's why I've translated it as beer and wine. okay. Right, so then, that's the five precepts. So the stream enter, of course, has these five precepts locked in, and they can't transgress them, can't break them. And then the next one is the four factors of stream entry. Again, this is taught quite a number of times. So again, quite briefly, so these factors of stream entry focus on faith. So the noble disciple has experiential confidence. That means that Pali is avecha pasada. So pasada is a confidence or faith. Avecha literally is a form that means having undergone. Okay, having undergone. So it's a confidence that comes from having undergone something. And so that's literally what it means here, because you have that faith. It doesn't arise from just an emotion or something like that. It arises from the actual vision of the truth. And you know that these things are true because you've seen them yourself. And, of course, this is expressed in terms of the Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho passage, which we have recited earlier. And again, I won't go into that in detail. Again, just to mention a couple of interesting points in the translation. One interesting detail is that the word nyaya here is that the Sangha of the Buddha's disciples is practicing the way that's good, direct, systematic, and proper. So I've translated it as systematic. It means nyaya means like a system or a method or something like that. And it's the same word which is used here for dependent origination itself. So dependent origination is described as the noble system. So again, this means that the one who's practicing the Buddha's path is practicing in accordance with dependent origination, or more broadly, in accordance with the principles of cause and effect that the Buddha pointed out and described. So that means our practice is in line with that system, in line with that method. As for the last part of that, this uses a few Vedic technical terms, which of course the Buddha is adopting and using for his own ends. Basically, he's using terms that would be that were terms of respect for Brahmins at that time, and he's applying it to the Sangha. So first one is worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods. So this is the Ahuneya. So this is the Ahuni, worthy of hospitality. This is worthy of hospitality is like a profound ancient virtue that we have, I think, largely forgotten or largely neglected, that we don't really think of hospitality as being such a virtue in that way. But for a lot of time, it really was, because if you were traveling, if you're going from one place to another, you didn't have Airbnb. And so when somebody showed up in your village, I mean, there's not a motel there or something like that, and they need a place to stay. And that virtue of actually extending hospitality to people and looking after them, you see this all the time in the suttas, that the Buddha's wandering around, shows up at someone's house, and they say, oh, please come and stay in my shed or stay in my house or stay, you know, in a park or something like that. And so that's that extension of hospitality. I always remember there's a beautiful Greek myth about this as well. So in ancient Greek mythology, the god of hospitality wanted to test the virtue of the people in a particular town. And so he manifested as a poor traveler, wandered through the town looking for a place to stay, and everybody turned him away from their doors until he came to the last house in the town, which was the poorest rundown house run by this old couple. And they received him in very kindly, and they apologized for the poverty of their place, and they fed him with the best food they had, which was just some cracked grain. And they set him down at the table, and the table legs were uneven, so it was propped up with a bit of wood to keep them even. And they apologized for the poverty of all of their things. But they were so kind with how they looked after that weary traveler. And in the morning, the weary traveler revealed his true nature, which was not just as the god of hospitality, but in fact, the weary traveler was Zeus himself. And so for the Greeks, the god of hospitality was in fact the king of the gods. That's how important that they thought that hospitality was. And then Zeus gave them, of course, a magnificent temple to live in from that time onwards. All right, so hospitality, worthy of a religious donation. So this is the dakina. So dakina was a payment which was expected by Brahmanical priests for performing of services, right? So you go along, you do a ritual, something like that, and you would get something out of it, and there was a fee. So in Buddhism, you're sort of worthy of that. We don't ask for a fee or anything like that, but this is a way of kind of adopting that into Buddhism. Okay. And Anjali, of course, we all know, is the making of Anjali. All right, so that's three of the four factors of stream entry. And then the fourth one, a noble disciple's ethical conduct is loved by the noble ones, unbroken, impeccable, spotless, and unmarred, liberating, praised by sensible people, not mistaken, and leading to immersion. So this is talking, of course, about the keeping of the five precepts and about how that is solid for a stream enterer. So far we've discussed the five precepts, we've discussed the four factors of stream entry, and notice how the last factor there, it says leading to immersion, samadhi sangwat tanika. Right? So these factors are support for the meditation, or support for development of samadhi in meditation. Now this particular sutta doesn't talk about samadhi further, but other suttas in this chapter do, and we'll talk about that sometime soon. So the final one, so the five precepts, the four factors of stream enterer, and then the last one is the noble system that they've clearly seen and penetrated with wisdom. And this, of course, is dependent origination itself. So when this exists, that comes to be. When this doesn't exist, that is not. Due to the arising of this arises. Due to the cessation of this, that ceases. So this I think, clarifies a few things. I've heard it said by some who say that dependent origination is just for like arahants or something like that, or dependent origination is just for something for monks or something like that. But clearly that's not the case. And I mean, those kinds of things are to my mind, a little bit silly, because that's not how the Dhamma works. The Dhamma is a universal principle of nature. It's not like there's certain things for some people and certain things for other people. So everybody, including for lay people, should have a good understanding of dependent origination. And this is an intrinsic part of that path. It's a part of that realization of the Dhamma, so that process of like rational reflection into the teaching. And notice how here again it's emphasizing the yoniso manasikara, the rational reflection. So that rational reflection leads us step by step towards an understanding. But the time of stream entry is also an occasion. And we need to be very clear about this as well. So the stream enterer from the beginning, from the time of the Buddha's first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the stream enterer realized at that moment what the truth was. So you see the vision of the Dhamma all at once. Right? And this is something which is made quite clear in the Vinaya. The Vinaya talks about what do you do if somebody claims to have seen the Dhamma or realized the Dhamma. How do you know whether they're in fact telling the truth? So one of the criteria that you can have for that is you ask them, when did that happen? Right? What were you doing? What were the circumstances? So somebody's had a genuine insight into the Dhamma should be able to tell you very clearly it was at this point in time. They will never forget that for the rest of their life. Right? It was at a specific point in time that they had that insight into the Dhamma, and that changed everything from then on. So, So this is how the realization of dependent origination emerges within or is placed within that broader context of the five precepts, the ethics, and the faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha as well. All right. So we've got a few notes here in the chat, so I'm just going to address those. Okay, Petra. Pet Monday, had someone stopped the process of enlightenment to become a bodhisattva, it's a blessing to join from Europe. Well, hey, Petra, how are you going? Good to see you. So it is a blessing for us to have you here. And I'm always amazed that people are finding time. To me, the fact that people find time and energy to want to engage with the Dhamma is always something that's amazing. And yeah, it redeems this world, because it's so easy to find things in this world that are going wrong or going badly. But the fact that there are people who want to turn their mind to something higher and to understand that is really beautiful. So, yeah, really happy to have you here. If someone stopped the process of enlightenment to become a bodhisattva. So when to understand the idea of the bodhisattva, then you need to distinguish between the idea of bodhisattva in the later schools and how bodhisattva is taught in the suttas. Okay, so as a historical scholar, then what I can tell you is this, that the word bodhisattva in the earlier suttas is used for the Buddha or any Buddha after leaving home when he's dedicated to enlightenment with the aim of achieving enlightenment until he realized enlightenment sometime later, in the case of Gotama 6 years later. And so the bodhisattva is a word that's used in that particular case. Obviously, in later forms of Buddhism, the word bodhisattva came to have a much broader, a much more significant meaning, and there's obviously a historical process and historical growth that's gone on there. So I won't go into that in too much detail, because that would take too long. That's a major topic in and of itself. But one thing simply to understand, that when we're reading the suttas, just don't be reading that bodhisattva idea into the suttas. This is one of the reasons why I translated it as one intent on awakening. So I actually translated the phrase rather than calling it a bodhisattva, because when you do that, people will just read it in terms of what they know. Okay, Tim. Okay, so Tim says, when I come across passages like this one, where still in life others spell out the whole dependent origination, it feels like inconsistency in a sense to me, because knowledge of these particular links of dependent origination seem to be an embodiment of the awakening experience itself, if my explanation makes sense. So Tim, it does make sense. Perhaps we've addressed this already in the discussion so far, but let me just repeat the main point that I made then, which is that there's a process of investigation and reflection which will be uncovering the links of dependent origination bit by bit. And the culmination of that, when all of the factors are ready and the mind is ripe for enlightenment, is that then you have the whole unitary intuitive vision of dependent origination, which we call stream entry. And so this is talking about the process that's leading up to those things. Scott, so what is it like changing your title from Secretary of Defense to Secretary of War? Scott, I'm not exactly sure how that's relevant for the current context. Nonetheless, look, all I'm going to say is that, I mean, to me, this is kind of like reverse Orwellianism, isn't it? I mean, like you'd think the idea that you call it Secretary of Defense, when in fact you're running a navy that runs around the whole world and invades whatever country it wants to, is somewhat of a misnomer. I don't know. Secretary of War seems more accurate. I don't think it's good, but at least they're honest about what they're doing. Anyway, in that particular respect. Okay. So Venerable Dhammakipa said, in India, a guest is considered like God, right? Atithi Devo Bhava is a core principle of Indian hospitality. Exactly. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. And I think, look, and you know, you can see how, you know, this is really embedded in that phrase, in the Pahuneya, which, you know, we recite as Buddhist, but we don't sort of really appreciate that that's the actual sense that it means. You know, and, you know, if you think about hospitality, right? What about hospitality? What about immigrants, right? What about asylum seekers, right? How are we expressing that sense of hospitality to people who are in need? You know, it's not, it's rare today that we would simply encounter a weary and dusty footed traveler outside of our house looking for a place to stay, right? But they come on the boats and they come on the planes and they come to our place and they're looking for a place and they need a place to stay. So that principle of hospitality, I think, is still very much, I think the way it happens changes, but it's still still even more urgent today, perhaps. So Scott says, some say the attainment of stream entry is knowable by the practitioner and can be tested. So yes, as I mentioned before, then that's the case certainly in the suttas and in the Vinaya. In the suttas, it says the realization of stream entry is like the flash of lightning in the blackness of night, right? So it's definitely something that you will know. It's unmistakable. So you can have a false positive about stream entry, right? You can think that you're a stream enterer and not really be one, okay? That's very common, okay? So that's common. But you can't have like a false negative. You can't like become a stream enterer and then think that nothing's happened. Like you might not know what it's called, right? If you don't have a lot of book knowledge or something like that, you can still have the insight into the truth. You know something's happened, you know, and you'll recognize that and you'll know it's, and you know, the fetters, the doubt and those things will be gone. You might not necessarily know what the technical term of that is, right? But you will definitely know that that experience has happened. But with the, does the faith follower have a similar point in time? Yeah, it's an interesting point. I don't think they do. So I don't think the faith follower and Dhamma follower, the suttas don't emphatically say in the same way that you would definitely know when that time is. So that's why in that kind of simile of the Cottesloe Beach simile, it's like you're pedaling up a hill and you kind of, you probably know more or less when you've pedaled enough to make it to the top, right? But you wouldn't necessarily be able to exactly say this pedal is the one that's got me there and that pedal is the one that I still don't have enough, right? But you pretty much know. So, yeah, that's a little bit of a grey area. Having said which, there's also a number of passages in the suttas where these people, Sadhanusari and Dhammanusari, are treated as ordinary people that you would know of. For example, it talks about inviting people for a mealtime or for a dana, including Sadhanusari and Dhammanusari as being invited for a meal. So I think that probably generally people would know, but I don't think necessarily that it's as clear cut as it is for the stream enterer. okay. Oh, thanks so much for those questions. Any questions from the room? Anyone here? Yeah, Edgar.
Is there any direct comparison with this independent origination?
Sorry?
Like a direct comparison, like one-to-one, like, oh, I tried to understand like a tree.
Okay.
Only the root, then you, which the ignorant, then you
right?
Turn it off, then everything kind of
yeah, apart. Yeah, yeah.
But it looks like even though you do like some of them, like number three, like consciousness or choice,
right?
The root's still there,
right?
You can't get rid of it, but still there. Right? That means right. Still can the second one, the choice, can come back again.
Sure, yeah.
If we have like a comparison, like in order for you to cut the root, like,
right?
Like 12 of them, right? You want to cut the number three, this is what you need to do. Cut number two, this is what you need to do.
Ah.
Number one, this is what. Like,
okay. So if you're asking about like are there specific practices for an antidote for like each one, right? In a way, yeah. I mean, I think the main antidotes obviously is for ignorance, and so any practice that's leading towards clarity, to mindfulness and wisdom, is then an antidote to ignorance. But yeah, the practice extends at each stage, and this is something I was going to talk about more a bit later on as you get a bit further into this. But yeah, I mean, each one of these, in a way, can be seen as something that you can understand, and that you, if you can respond to it, that means you can practice regarding it. Right? I mean, just a simple example, if you choose old age, right? I mean, you can't stop old age from happening, but you can reflect about it and you can understand, you can accept it, and you can try to learn to age gracefully and with wisdom. And by doing that, then that's a way of practicing with regards to old age. So, yeah, we might get more into that next week, I think. There's some more ones on practice for next week. So Scott, I think clarifying the Secretary of War thing was referring to the statecraft practice of old millennia and the recent American Secretary's name change. Right. So, yes, sorry, I lost the context because we were read it a bit later. But, yeah, that's right, yeah. And look, I mean, it's highly disturbing, this whole kind of thing. But, I don't know what to say. Anyway, Dhammakipa has a question. Please, Venerable, open the mic, yeah.
Might be kind of a stupid question, but it's not the translation about old age and death, you know, rebirth is a condition for old age and death in the Paticca-samuppada. And before I wrote something that, of course, it's obvious that every phase of aging, there is an element of suffering. But my question is about the translation, because, you know, we say old age, but for me, if you really meditate or you think about every phase of aging, like seriously, from the moment of conception at a certain point in the womb, it's very tight in there. Then you're born, that's pretty traumatic. And then as a toddler, everybody loves you and thinks you're the best thing since, you know, sliced bread. Then you go to school and all of a sudden you realize, hey, everybody thinks that. I mean, not to mention even the angst of being a teenager. There's so much suffering in that age. So my question is, why is old age, which for many people is so far away, even for elderly people, sometimes they don't.
I know, so very far away.
Yes, exactly. Instead of the aging, suffering, aging and death, you know.
You're asking aging? And why isn't it aging and death? Yeah. Obviously,
you know, older.
Yeah. So obviously what you're saying is true, and obviously there is suffering at each one of those points in the path and so on. If you look at the way that jara is defined in the suttas, it's defined explicitly as old age, like wrinkled skin, broken teeth, and these kinds of things. This was actually between Bhikkhu Bodhi and Venerable Brahmali during Venerable Bodhi's translation of the Samyutta Nikaya. So previous to that, Bhikkhu Bodhi had translated jara as aging. And Venerable Brahmali argued that it actually, if you look at how it's used contextually, it has to mean old age. And it might seem like it's a kind of trivial difference. I mean, obviously you can understand it both ways. But if you look at the way jara is used, then I think Brahmali was quite right that it does mean old age. So, yes, I think you can, see that process of aging as bringing in that suffering, which happens at every stage. This is very true. But the word jara means old age for whatever reason, yeah. Just a bit of context for that. When Bhikkhu Bodhi was translating the Samyutta Nikaya, he was still in Sri Lanka at the time, And we were in, I was at Bodhnyana, and we were in contact with him. And he, those days were like, that was like, we were just, it was the first days of the computer and stuff like that. And there was this kind of magic thing called email, and he could actually email us a copy of his draft and we could read through it. And so a bunch of us read through his draft and gave him various feedback and so on for that. So that was kind of a very great honor to be able to be part of that process. Okay, I think we should probably leave that there. Let's wrap up for this evening. Thanks, everybody, for your attention. Thank you so much for your presence. Next week, we'll discuss a couple more suttas that talk about the practice with regards to dependent origination. And that will probably, I think next week will be the last one in this series on dependent origination. We will see how we go, but I think that will probably be the last one. And let me just reiterate that that these have been recorded, and so please check on lokanta.live if you want those, if you want to revisit them. Please do welcome questions, especially for next week, and to hopefully clear up any lingering doubts that you might have. It's been a long journey.
Is there any cliffhanger, I think?
Any cliffhangers? I should put in a cliffhanger, shouldn't I? Make sure you'll come back next week. And I think a cliffhanger is a cheap storytelling device. I think a story should like finish, and you should the reason that you should want to have more should be because the story gave you a sense of satisfaction, and you should feel happy and could go back more rather than feeling a sense of dissatisfaction. Personally, it's the only thing wrong with The Empire Strikes Back. Ended on a cliffhanger. Anyway, thanks, thanks everybody. We will please stay happy and stay safe, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week.
That's so sad.